Thank you for joining me. I'm Kimberly Rogers, and you're listening to this week's Torah portion from Friday sundown to Saturday sundown. This message is brought to you by themessianicmessage.com. themessianicmessage.com. I hope that you enjoy this teaching. This week's Torah portion is called Pekudei. It means accounts of. It is Exodus chapter 38, starting at verse 21, to Exodus 40, verse 38. The Haftarah is 1 Kings chapter 7 to chapter 8, verse 21, and the Brit Hadashah is 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 16 and 17, and Hebrews chapter 13, verse 10. Before we get started, let's say a word of prayer. Baruch atah Yehovah Eloheinu melech haolam. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe. You are the creator of all things and the shield of this family of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Protect us and keep us, preserve us all around the earth. Whoever is keeping the Sabbath today, protect us, Abba. Show us your wisdom and understanding, and let everything that comes from me fall by the wayside and die. But let your words that come through me come forth and flourish, and let people understand and hear the truth and get wisdom through you, Abba. I give you the glory and the honor and the praise for that. In Yeshua's name, amen. Okay, so I think that what this word Pekudei means is it is a summary. See, we got the instructions, and then we got the actual building of the tabernacle that was done according to the instructions. And now we're being given a summary of what happened here in Pekudei. And so that's why I'm calling this the summary with a lesson in faith. Well, as I said, first, we get the instructions. Moses goes up on the mountain in Exodus 25, verse 1, and going to Exodus 31, 18 is all the instructions for building the tabernacle and doing the priest's robes and all of that, the instruction for the construction of the items that will be used to serve the Lord. Now, later on, we're going to get the instruction about how to do the sacrifices. That was not part of what was given in the instruction to Moses. We're going to get that starting in Vayikra, Leviticus. But for building the tabernacle and the furnishings and the priestly garments, that's what we get in those instructions between chapters 25 and 31 in the book of Exodus. Now, I want to revisit something because even though it's not mentioned in this Torah portion, it's relevant to this Torah portion, and that is the golden calf incident. You see, there's a reason why they were afraid, and it's going to impact now everything else that they do moving forward. They're going to see Moses in a little bit different light, and as a matter of fact, this Torah portion tells us that Moses gets a different status. And the people are going to see that, and it's good for them to see that, and I will explain that a little bit later on. In Exodus 32:1, it says, when the people saw that Moses took a long time to come down the mountain, they gathered around Aaron and told him, come here and make us a god who will go before us, because, as for this fellow Moses who led us out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what has become of him. Now, what I think is going on with these people is that they don't have a personal relationship with Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, God, Yeshua. Moses is everything to them. Moses is their king, and he is the one that commands God in their eyes. Now think about this, because that's what Pharaoh does. Pharaoh commands the gods, and they had lived under this culture of a king, a theocracy, in which the king was also a high priest and commanded the gods. And in their mind, I don't think they see any different. In fact, it says, come here and let us make an Elohim, a mighty one, who will go before us. So, and then they say, Moses, who led us out of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him. So, to them, Moses is the main character, not Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, because Moses shows up, says that he is there on behalf of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. He's got a new name that nobody ever knew before, and that makes him pretty important. And then he did all these miracles, before the people. He led them out of Egypt. He put his staff out and the Red Sea opened up. I mean, you know, they see Moses doing this. And if God gets any kind of credit at all, it's because Moses has command of him. I really think that that's what they think today. And as a matter of fact, I believe that right now as we speak on the earth, millions and billions of people actually still believe this. They look to Moses for their salvation. I think in the Hebrew Roots community, we're looking to Moses for our salvation. In Judaism, I think they look to Moses for their salvation. I think even Christians have a little bit of this looking to Moses in the form of good works, the works that they choose to do. Not all of them, but what they choose. I think that the human mind has a hard time coming to grips with the fact that we don't get our salvation through Moses, through the law of Moses. That we get it because we have a God who is our Savior and our Deliverer. But you see, this is where it's going to lead us to having proper faith, which I'm going to go to in a little bit. So, I think these people are still henotheists, and henotheists, as you know, believe that there is a supreme God, and Moses is the commander of that supreme God, because in their minds, that's what people do with gods. You know, you got a problem, you go to that God, and you get your problem solved, you see. And at this point, when they had the golden calf incident, they had not yet gotten the instruction about the tabernacle and the priesthood. They didn't know that Aaron was going to have anything important to do. They didn't know that Hur's grandson was going to have anything important to do. So even though Moses had left instruction with the people that they could speak to Aaron and Hur about their problems, with Moses gone, the people were left without a leader, without somebody to go before them into battle. You see, that's probably why they were scared. They were surrounded by their enemies. You know, when you win a fight, you know there's somebody coming around the corner that wants to see if they can take you down. You know, there's always somebody that wants to prove they're bigger than you, right? So they're surrounded by their enemies. Moses isn't there. He's the one that's been winning the battles with them. Remember at Rephidim, Moses made that happen, right? And so now he's gone. They have no king. They don't know what they're going to do. So they go to Aaron and Hur and tell Aaron and Hur what to do rather than asking Aaron and Hur what to do. But that's a whole other topic right there, so I'll skip that one for now. In Exodus 24:14 is where Moses told Aaron and Hur to be the ones that settle disputes. He says, wait here for us till we return to you. Look, Aaron and Hur are with you. Whoever has a dispute, let him come to them. What kind of dispute did they have? Well, they had a dispute with Moses, and they had a dispute with God. So they went to Aaron and Hur, and they got themselves a representation of God that could go before them into battle, because I think that's what was on their minds. The ancient mindset was not one of faith. It was one of pacifying one's God. So that's why it is so extraordinary in Genesis that we read that Abraham had faith and it was credited to him for righteousness. Because back in those days, that is not how people walked out their religious path. The gods were seen as being there only to help them get what they needed, you know, to keep the earth doing what it needed to do so that they could continue to live. This faith thing was foreign to them, and I will submit to you that faith is still foreign to us, but not quite as foreign to us as it was in the time of Abraham and in the time of Moses and this first generation. But I submit to you that faith is still a difficult thing to wrap our minds and hearts around, and we're going to talk more about that as we go along. Now, further evidence of my understanding that these people were fearful of Moses not returning because he would not be there to go before them in battle was when the Lord pacified them, saying that he will go ahead and go before them. In Exodus 33:1, after Moses had done the intercession for them, it says, "The Lord told Moses, 'Go up from here, you and the people whom you brought out of Egypt, to the land about which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, I'll give it to your descendants. I will send an angel in front of you, and I will drive out the Canaanites, the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Go up to a land flowing with milk and honey, but I won't go up among you because you are an obstinate people, and otherwise I might consume you along the way.' When the people heard this troubling word, they mourned, and no one put on his ornaments." So you see, their concern was, you know, who's going to go before us in the battles? So Yeshua is going to tell them here, I'm not going to go before you, but I'm going to send my messenger who will go before you. And this was to pacify them so that they would understand who it is that's going before them. And the Lord has been telling them all along that it was him doing these great works and not Moses. But we have here a hint of the people's mindset when the Lord tells him to Moses to bring the people into the land, because he says, "Go up from here, you and the people whom you brought out of Egypt." If they want to believe that, go ahead. Go ahead, believe that. But then he goes on to say, "I will send help in front of you." So I think there the Lord is literally addressing what their mindset is, that they think Moses did it. And they're fearful, and they were fearful at the golden calf incident, that they were not going to have someone to go before them in battle. And that is what that golden calf was about. They probably planned to carry that thing in front of them into battle. So this is a faith issue, and it pertains to the summation of the instructions that were given to Moses and to the actual construction work that was done, because Pekudei summarizes those instructions and the work that was done, and in the middle of that came this golden calf incident. So now we have the instructions for the tabernacle, and we now have to get past the golden calf incident. So Moses goes back to the mountain to get new tablets. Then he returns with the new tablet, and this time he also returns with the instructions. So now we get additional commandments in chapter 34. You know, keep the Sabbath and so forth. And we've already talked at length about commandments about keeping the Sabbath and keeping the feasts and so forth. And so we're going to go on to Exodus 35, where Moses assembles the people to tell them what to bring in order to build the tabernacle, and also to tell the people who were no longer wearing their ornaments what they should bring if the Lord moved them to bring something. In Exodus 33:5, it says, "The Lord told Moses, 'Say to the Israelites, you are an obstinate people, and if for one moment I went up among you, I would put an end to you. Now take off your ornaments so that I may decide what to do with you.' So the Israelites did not wear their ornaments from Mount Horeb onward," it says in verse 6. In chapter 35, verse 21, it says, "And every person whose heart moved him and all whose spirits prompted them brought an offering to the Lord for constructing the tent of meeting, for all its services and for the holy garments. Both the men and women came, all whose hearts prompted them, and brought brooches, earrings, rings, pendants, and all kinds of gold jewelry. Every person presented a wave offering of gold to the Lord. What they brought were those ornaments that they were not wearing anymore, because they had been told to put those off, to take them off." So then, of course, they did go ahead and bring all of that and some other required items, which included the gold, the silver, bronze, the animal skins, etc. Then the Lord told the congregation that there were going to be two men whom he had selected to oversee the construction work. In Exodus 35:30, Moses told the Israelites, "Look, the Lord has called Uri's son Bezalel, grandson of Hur, from the tribe of Judah, and he has filled him with the Spirit of God, with wisdom, with understanding, and with knowledge of all kinds of work, to make artistic designs, to work in gold, silver, and bronze, to cut stones for setting, to carve wood, and to engage in all kinds of artistic work. He has given him, both him and Ahisamach's son, Aholiab, from the tribe of Dan, the ability to teach. And he has equipped them to do all kinds of work done by an engraver, designer, embroider in blue, purple, and scarlet material, and in fine linen, or as a weaver. They were able to do all kinds of work and were skilled designers." Now, it's a fallacy that everyone in the congregation participated in the construction of the tabernacle. And it's a fallacy that they all knew and understood the instructions. Here's what really happened. Moses got all of the instructions. Then Bezalel and Aholiab were given the knowledge that they needed so that they could oversee the workers, who would only know what their part of that project was going to be. Moses got all of the instructions because Moses is the expert. He's the one that we go to when we need instruction to walk out our life. Bezalel and Aholiab are examples of how the Lord takes people from the congregation to do a special work for him. We have here this lesson that the Lord makes a selection. He has people that do certain jobs. Sometimes he fills people with a lot of knowledge, wisdom, and understanding, and then he gives others a little bit of this. Now, we don't know why this is the way it is, but I want to share something with you about the construction of the tabernacle, because this generation is credited with having built the tabernacle. In the understanding of the temple, it is that in the generation when that temple is built, that entire generation is credited with having built that generation. But do you know that the Lord credits every generation with having built the tabernacle? Because it is that when you participate by reading or understanding or even being present when it's going on, then the Lord credits it to you as if you had participated in the actual building. That's why it's so important to understand this tabernacle and to understand the temple and those services and everything about it, because when we study that, the Lord credits it to us as if we have participated in the building of this structure. And so we want to be credited with that, because the bride needs to know these things in order to qualify. And so it is good that we study these things. And, you know, He gives people a lot of knowledge in them so that they can teach others. This is what is said about Bezalel and Aholiab. He had given them the ability to teach, you see. So the Lord fills some people with knowledge and wisdom and understanding, and they teach it to other people. And by the way, guess what? If you're being taught and you have an interest in it while you're being taught, the Lord is crediting it to you as if you have built the tabernacle and the temple and so forth. Because He credits this entire generation with having built this tabernacle, even though He chose Bezalel and Aholiab, who taught others. And you see, we're not given specific names and numbers of how many others and who they were that built this tabernacle, yet this generation is the one that did it. So, you know, the Lord is merciful to us. He credits us with our heart's intent. You know, He credits us if we have a love for Him, for the tabernacle, for the temple. He credits us much more than what we actually do. He credits that to us. Isn't He wonderful? In chapters 36, starting at verse 1 to chapter 38, verse 20, we then find the verification of Bezalel and Aholiab's work according to the Lord's instructions. Now, it is important that we not only get the instruction from Moses, but that we understand that the work was done according to the Lord's instruction. Why is this important? It is so that there can be no future accusation against Bezalel, Aholiab, that generation who built the structure, or against the tabernacle itself. See, time that the Lord spent from chapter 36:1 to chapter 38:20 telling us that this was done according to instruction is a legal issue. It is not only a testament of Bezalel's and Aholiab's and that congregation's example of how they followed the Lord. It's not only a testament to that, but it is also addressing a legal issue. And why do I say that? Well, it is because today, at the end of days, there are people who deny the existence of the former two temples on Mount Zion. Now, these two temples were patterned after the tabernacle. So, if there was any fault in the tabernacle's construction, then you see, a legal case could be made that the temples that stood on Mount Zion were faulty and therefore were subject to eternal faultiness and, you know, being subject to being deconstructed and thus non-existent. But such is not the case. They were made according to the Lord's instructions. So because of that, people somehow in their spirits and the enemy also knows that human beings have to deny the actual existence of the temples because there was no fault found in the work that was done by the original builders, Bezalel and Aholiab, according to the instructions that the Lord gave to Moses. So he's protecting the integrity of the legality of this, you see. Then in Exodus 38:21, we have the summary. It's called a counting or a peccadé. The purpose of a summary is to conclude the matter without giving all of the details. You know, it just sums it all up. The teaching model of Exodus is that the Lord tells us what he's going to tell us. Then he tells us what is being done. And then he tells us what was done. So he tells us what he's going to do. He tells us what is being done. Then he tells us what was done. This is an excellent teaching model because he addresses the situation in the future and in the present and then in the past tense. Again, for the purpose of protecting the integrity and workmanship of the legality of the tabernacle and future temples for all generations, all the way to the end of time. This is also a lesson for us in our need to be careful to follow the Lord's instructions as he gives them to us in our personal lives. You know, that we don't go around changing what he said. Of course, there are all kinds of lessons that we have learned from the construction of the tabernacle, and it's almost like it's a never-ending subject. There's just more and more and more that we can learn from the construction of the tabernacle because it is the basis of the Lord's dwelling moving forward for all eternity. So in Exodus 38:21, we get a summary of materials for the tent of meeting that was compiled at Moses' direction and the work of the descendants of Levi under the direction of Aaron, the priest's son Itamar. That's what it says there in Exodus 38:21. So Peccadé is the summation of the legal document describing exactly how to build a proper place for the Lord to dwell. It is interesting, though, in this Torah portion, that we find out where Moses once could go into the presence of the Lord on the mountain. We find out here that Moses' status has changed. Remember, I mentioned this before, a few minutes ago, and I was told you I was going to address it. Moses could go into the glory of the Lord on the mountain. Let's go to Exodus 24:15. When Moses went up on the mountain, the cloud covered it. The glory, the kavod of the Lord settled on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it for 6 days. Then on the seventh day, he called to Moses from within the cloud. To the Israelites, the appearance of the glory, the kavod, of the Lord was like a consuming fire on top of the mountain. When Moses went up on the mountain, he went into the center of the cloud and was on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. But here, in Exodus 40, verse 34, it says, the cloud covered the tent of meeting. The glory, kavod, of the Lord filled the tent. Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled on it and the glory, the kavod of the Lord filled the tent. So what is the difference? Why could Moses get inside the kavod, the glory of the Lord, before and now he cannot? It is because Moses was not a king or a priest, even though the people did not understand this yet. You see, only the designated one, the high priest, now can enter that inner space where the glory dwells. This means that Moses has now had a change of status. There's been a transition. A threshold has been crossed. What was the threshold that was crossed? The tabernacle and the priest's garments have been constructed. That was the transition between Moses being able to go into the cloud of glory and not being able to go into the cloud of glory. Now, that means then that the Lord has designated an authorized person, and Moses was not authorized for that place. Moses had a specific authorization, which was to get the instruction. For that, he was allowed to go into the glory, because that's where the instruction came from, was the place of glory, the place of the kavod. But that's where Moses' authorization ends, because now the priesthood is going to begin functioning. And so this is where Moses' sole leadership of the assembly ends and that of the priesthood begins. Now, humanly speaking, it would make sense that the Lord would continue allowing Moses to enter therein. But, you know, that kind of thinking then diminishes the Lord's sovereignty. He alone decides who, when, where, how. And when our time of service is over, it is over. And so for Moses, this phase of his service to the Lord is concluding. Now, having our service to the Lord come to an end is not a testimony about our character, but it is a testimony of the transition that is happening on the earth or in our lives or both, in which our services are no longer required by the Lord because something new is coming. Now, what is this new thing that is coming there in the wilderness? Well, it is that the people will no longer look to Moses for leadership, because now the kavod, the glory, the pillar of fire and cloud will be centralized in the tabernacle and will rule. This signals to the people and to Moses that the pillar and the cloud that they have gotten used to, you know, that's they're following in the desert, it is not just there anymore. It's not just, you know, like Moses has commanded this thing. Now they're going to see, know that this pillar of cloud and fire, it is now going to be their leader, and it requires, that glory of the Lord requires a specially authorized priesthood and a specially authorized high priest to be able to function within it, you see? So, really, this pillar of cloud and fire becomes their king. And this glory dwells in this movable palace of the king. So now the Lord is transitioning the people to see who really is their king. So whereas they probably thought Moses was their king before, now the Lord is going to show them that there can only be one king in the palace. So this is a paradigm shift. They've been following this pillar of cloud and fire everywhere, but now they are going to follow it when it arises from its place in its palace, its dwelling called the tabernacle, because now they're going to see that this glory is their king. And so it says here in Exodus 40, verse 36, when the cloud was lifted up from the tent, the Israelites would set out on their journey. But if the cloud was not lifted up, they would not set out until it was lifted up. For the cloud of the Lord was over the tent by day, and the fire was in it by night, in the sight of all the house of Israel in all their journeys. They're learning to follow the Lord, not Moses. They're learning to live by faith. They're learning to pay attention to the glory of the Lord. Now, we try to pay attention to the glory of the Lord in our lives, but we don't have a pillar of cloud and fire. We will have, but we don't have right now. We have to rely on the still small voice, which is the tiniest amount of glory that we can have in our lives and that we can be present in. Now, you know, when Joshua took the people in the tabernacle across the Jordan, we don't read about there being the pillar of cloud and fire at that point. And of course, during their many years of wandering around in Israel, doing battles and trying to take the land and so forth from the time of Joshua forward, we learn that the Ark of the Covenant got stolen, and we learned that the tabernacle really wasn't as central to them as it should have been, and so forth. So there was a dwindling away of understanding, a dwindling away of wanting to be in the presence of the glory, a dwindling away of seeing the work of the Lord in their lives because they were not focused on the tabernacle and the glory. And so you'll remember that part of that story involves the people calling for a king. Well, they called for their king. They called for the Lord to give them a king because they did not have faith. They did not understand that God was still functioning through that tabernacle that they were neglecting. And if they had not neglected the tabernacle, they would have felt no need for a king because they would have had the faith of Abraham. They would have been counted as righteous for having this faith of Abraham. But because those people, after the time of Joshua, going into the time of Samuel and Kings and Chronicles, failed to focus their attention on the glory of the tabernacle, the glory of the dwelling place of the Lord, they ended up making themselves beholden to a king. So right up to that point even, they were still henotheistic. It's probably they became polytheistic because polytheism surrounded the Israelites during that time. So when Yeshua came, part of his mission was to teach us to have the faith of Abraham, which, I said before, was an unusual mindset at that time. It is why the writer of Hebrews had to give us the definition of faith. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. See, we don't get to see our Creator, but we have faith that there is a Creator, that He is present in our lives. But to the logical human mind, it does not make sense to have this faith. You know, and like I said before, if people wanted to approach a problem and get a solution to a problem, well, they would go and sacrifice to the God that dealt with such things. You know, thunder, rain, fertility, whatever your problem. There were thousands of them. If you had a particular problem, you went to see that God and you sacrificed to that God. And if you got an answer, then you said, oh, that God gave me the answer. And if you didn't get an answer, then you said, well, that God is, you know, he's mad at me. So you see what I mean? That's not living by faith when you do that. Living by faith means you bring your petition to the one God, the Creator, the supreme and only. When I say supreme, I mean only God of the universe. And you just sit back and watch what he does. That takes patience, and it takes a particular mindset that these people did not have, and I think it's something that we still struggle with today. But nevertheless, very soon, maybe in this generation, it can't be far off, we are going to get to see with our eyes our King Yeshua coming to reign on the earth from David's throne in the Messianic temple, where there's going to be a functioning priesthood again. He's going to gather us all back and bring the exiles home and set up his kingdom here. And I can tell you this, I can't wait. I hope this Torah portion has been a blessing to you. Give credit where credit is due to the one and only God, Creator Yeshua, to whom all glory and honor is due. In Yeshua's name, amen. Shabbat Shalom.